A few months ago, I had this experience where in the spring of 2024, I was traveling through the mountains of northern Italy, and I happened into what I'm pretty sure was the cave of the Sibyl. And in that cave, I found leaves containing ancient scattered writings in many languages, including what I'm pretty sure was English. And I've spent the last few months assembling those scattered leaves into, you know, I could be wrong, but what seems to be a podcast transcript. So I've asked two of my friends, Patrick Barney and Chris Malmberg, to work with me in using that transcript to recreate the podcast, which actually, as it turned out, coincidentally, was an episode of our podcast, Book Spider, of which they are the two co-hosts. So in this podcast transcript that I found in the scattered ruins of the Cave of Sibyl, the topic of that podcast is The Last Man by Mary Shelley, which is published in 1826. And this was about 8 years after the publication of Frankenstein. And it was, to my understanding, a little bit, it was fairly poorly received and a little bit of a, if not a career killer, like something that, you know, kind of broke the run of success she'd been having for a while after Frankenstein. And The Last Man is narrated by Lionel Verney, who at the end of the novel becomes, to his knowledge, the titular last man on earth, the lone survivor of a plague, which over the course of a few years has wiped out every other human being. And The Last Man begins in the year 2070, so still pretty far into the future, even by our current standards. And in 2070, the 2070-ish, I don't remember the exact year, but in the 2070s, the English monarchy is eliminated in favor of a republican system of government. And Lionel, our narrator, is a poor orphan who befriends the a person named Adrian, Earl of Windsor, who would have been the King of England if such a thing still existed. And Lionel marries Adrian's sister Idris and befriends a nobleman named Raymond, who marries Lionel's sister Perdita. And Raymond initially has ambitions to reinstate the monarchy and become kind of a Napoleon-style conqueror. But those ambitions are abandoned when he falls in love with Perdita. But Raymond's marriage to Perdita falls apart following the discovery of his affair with the Greek woman Evadne. And Raymond is so distraught that he joins the Greek army in their battle to reconquer Constantinople from the Turks, now, of course, called Istanbul, but in the parallel universe of this novel, still in the 2070s, called Constantinople. During that battle, he dies in an explosion. Lionel travels to Constantinople to recover the body, drugs Perdita to prevent her from staying with Raymond, and that causes her to commit suicide. And then at that point, the shit really hits the fan, because a plague emerges from Constantinople. The plague perhaps is caused by a curse that Evadne applies to Raymond. That's a little bit uncertain. But over the course of a few years, the plague eradicates the population of every country in the world, reduces all of humanity perhaps to a few thousand people. England is one of the last countries to be attacked by the plague, but Lionel watches as gradually English people begin falling sick, dying in mass. And we see numerous scenes of tragic death, of empty cities, of people doing their best to carry on, to love each other, to form bonds and keep society going, but inevitably it collapses. A diminishing band of survivors embarks on a pilgrimage to Switzerland, led by Lionel and Adrian. But the depredations of plague continue until, by all appearances, the last three people on Earth are Lionel, Adrian, and Lionel's niece Clara. Then Adrian and Clara die in a sailing accident, and Lionel is the only survivor of humanity, wandering an empty world on an endless journey to find any human contact and writing a memoir of his life describing how he became the last man on Earth. Any significant threads that I left out of that synopsis that you want to make sure we establish before we begin?
I wanted to establish something. So You wrote Raymond's marriage to Perdita falls apart through the discovery of his affair with the Greek woman Evadne. And was there actually an affair, or was it?
I think there was.
Was there?
I kind of went back and forth on that. Well, yeah, it's stated in a court in a vague sort of way. I wasn't totally clear on it, but it seemed as though there was, in fact, an affair. It was a little hard to tell if there was an affair or if he was just visiting her. It's not clear whether he's just visiting her in a friendly way and helping her out, or if he is, in fact, sleeping with her or in love with her somehow. But, I mean, I think, like, it, regardless of the nature of what's happening, whatever contact he's having and keeping from his wife is, you know, by the standards of 1800s England, which have been transposed onto the 2070s, he's doing something that morally counts as being an affair. I think it's kind of the moral importance of an affair, even though it's unclear if he's, you know,
right,
doing anything that by contemporary standards would be considered at all improper.
I my interpretation that he might have been emotionally unfaithful, but I didn't know if they actually
consummated
or you know did
bucked
yeah did the deed basically.
Yeah, that's unclear to me as well. And it might be that somebody reading it with the sensibilities of 1826 would have a clearer idea of what's being implied, but I was not clear. But whatever it is, it has the moral gravity of an affair, even if it is not infidelity as we would understand.
Sure.
I was going to add something too, which is the autobiographical kind of pieces of this. You know, you mentioned Raymond's potential affair. You know, he's, I guess, based on Byron, Lord Byron, which if you know the history, George Gordon, Lord Byron, went to Greece to fight in the Civil War and was very close friends with and did a lot of traveling with. And this is kind of a traveling novel. They're just kind of all over the place. But traveling with Percy Bysshe Shelley and his wife at the time, Mary Shelley, and you mentioned Adrian drowning in a shipwreck, and that's how Percy Bysshe Shelley died. So. And regardless whether there was or was not an affair, Lord Byron was pretty known for having a lot of affairs. So I don't know how that colors necessarily like the reading of it, but
well, it could color it very deeply if you wanted to, right? And that's one thing that I wasn't really thinking about until the end of the book, because I didn't do a lot of secondary reading around it until I'd finished it. So I didn't, you know, I didn't know the biographies well enough to make the connection between Adrian and Percy Shelley or between Raymond and Lord Byron. But it does seem to be generally accepted, yeah, that those are the models for those two characters. And I mean, if you think about the context of her life, right, like she had, if I remember right, three of her four children died of disease in infancy, and her husband died in a sailing accident. And so in a certain way, it's like the circumstances of the novel are taking the circumstances of her life and kind of blowing them up to an epic proportion as a way of, you could read it, I suppose, and I don't know if this is like a standard reading, but it's very hard to avoid, right? Like the idea that in some way she's kind of creating this metaphorical, this kind of large canvas metaphorical evocation of the solitude and desolation that she would have felt, right? As someone who basically whose entire family, other than one son, had passed away tragically and who lost the friends that she did. And so it's like in, you know, almost such a transparent reading that it's not even like that clever a thing to say, right? But it's hard not to see it as a novel about grief, right? And about her grief in this fairly transparent way. There's a, in the introduction that I was kind of making fun of in the opening bit there, in the, so the, for context for people who haven't read this recently, the presentation of the novel is as something that was writings that were found in a cave in the 1800s, right? And the there's a passage in the introduction that I found very interesting, where the anonymous introducer, the anonymous person who has found the sheets of writing of this story, says something like, "My labors have cheered long hours of solitude and taken me out of a world which has averted its once benign face from me to one glowing with imagination and power. Will my readers ask how I could find solace from the narration of misery and woeful change? This is one of the mysteries of our nature which holds full sway over me and from whose influences I cannot escape. I confess that I have not been unmoved by the development of the tale, and that I have been depressed, nay, agonized at some parts of the recital, which I have faithfully transcribed. Yet such is human nature that the excitement of mind was dear to me, and the imagination, painter of tempest and earthquake, or worse, the stormy and ruin-fraught passions of man, softened my real sorrows and endless regrets by clothing these fictitious ones in that ideality which takes the mortal sting from pain." So, I mean, that seems to me like a very slightly veiled discussion of the ways in which writing this fictionalized version of her own trauma, if that's not too overplayed a word, right, in which writing this fictionalized version of her own traumatic experience has been, in fact, therapeutic and soothing and a way of processing, right? And that's, you know, kind of bland modern therapy language, but that passage, coming back to that passage, knowing the ways that this resonates with the events of her own life, I found it very moving, and it made me much more sympathetic to the novel as a whole, which I was not unsympathetic to already, right? But it's kind of, it's interesting because it's both this, you know, world scale kind of quasi sci-fi horror novel, but then also can very much be read as this kind of intimate act of grieving and personal personal exploration. So I actually, I was going to kind of bring that in last, but Chris, you know, you brought up the Byron and the Shelley resemblances, and it was hard not to touch on that there. But getting kind of back to the way, leaving aside the personal aspects of this for Mary Shelley and thinking again more about the ways this prefigures a lot of sci-fi and horror. I don't know if the two of you were familiar with this work at all before, if you'd heard of it or knew anything about it. If you had, maybe the underlying premise of this question is invalid, but I hadn't heard of this novel until about 3 weeks ago, and the idea of an apocalyptic super plague wiping out all of humanity except for a small number of isolated survivors, you know, in the last maybe 50 years, give or take, like that's become very established as a fictional trope, right? In books and film and TV, things like The Stand, Last Man on Earth, Station 11. Also, more broadly, the trope of one or two or a very small number of people kind of roaming through the emptied out ruins left of the world after humanity, even for reasons that aren't directly connected to a plague, right? Things like The Quiet Earth or Night of the Comet. Those are very common fictional tropes that, to my own knowledge at least, this seems to be ground zero for, right? Like this is the beginning of a couple of the earliest instance I'm aware of that kind of model of plot. And I think would have been strikingly original in its day, right? But it was very poorly received in its time, and to my awareness, it remains mostly forgotten. You know, when the COVID happened, there were one or two articles online that tried to present it as a lost classic with new relevance, but those don't seem to really have had much impact. So, you know, why do you think that this book lives in such obscurity and disrepute, if indeed it does?
Pacing?
Yeah, I think you're onto something there. You want to elaborate a bit?
That is the perfect, perfect answer, Patrick.
I'm sympathetic to this novel. Like, I think there's actually a lot to like about this book. I'm sure we'll get deeper into that, but it's a pretty long book. I mean, I don't know exactly how many pages it is, but in audiobook format, it's like 22 hours, and that's like about the same length as East of Eden, which is 620 pages, I think.
Yeah, my copy was about 560 pages, but like pretty densely packed. My copy of Last Man on Earth is about 560 pages, and that's, you know, there are very few paragraph breaks, right? That's 500 some pages of page long paragraphs and minimal dialogue.
Yeah, I mean, it just seems like the novel moves too slow, you know? Like we don't even get to the plague until halfway into the book, you know, like, and not that what comes before, actually I find the first half more interesting and than I think the second half, but you know.
Oh, you do, really? That surprises me. I'll be honest, like up until the plague, as I was reading it, I thought, oh man, I fucked up. Like, I felt bad for making you guys read it for the first 200 or so pages, actually.
No, I actually think the first half of the novel is extremely interesting thematically and probably more interesting plot-wise. Like, plot-wise after that, like, with the plague, there's hardly any interpersonal conflict. I mean, maybe not. Maybe that's not right. Right. But like,
well, there's not much. No, I mean, there are scattered events, right? But the thing about, like, once the plague happens, in some way, nothing that anybody does matters, mm-hmm. right? Like, right. There are lots of little incidents of these people fall in love, or this person is rescued from solitude, or, you know, these people, there's a little kind of civil war between, like, where Americans, you know, move into empty Ireland and then the American Irish coalition marches on London or something like that. But then it just kind of inevitably it all fizzles into, and then they all die of the plague.
Right.
Which I guess you could read as being thematic in its own way, right? Like the kind of weight of mortality just over and over again sweeps away all these smaller conflicts and passions and things that people think are important that turn out not to be. You could read that as thematic, but I mean, it's one of those things where when your thematic device in a fictional work is to make the normal techniques of fiction irrelevant, that might be conceptually interesting, but then how do you make it engaging as fiction, right?
But in contrast, the first half of the half of the novel has, you know, a guy who wants to take over the world, but reestablish a monarchy with maybe him as the head. But then he falls in love and he like does a 180 and he's like, I know what I'll do. I'll solve world poverty. And, you know, making Raymond kind of an interesting, complex, shifting, mercurial, but decent character. And he falls in love with Perditor, the narrator. My narrator pronounced it Perditor, you know, even though, because he's like some weird English dude who can't read Perdita. I thought the whole like Raymond arc, I found that to be pretty interesting. Whereas when you get to the plague, like you said, Hans, nothing seems to, everything is so drowned out by the weight of the plague that, you know, people's lives don't seem to matter.
Well, and also this is not, it's such an interesting, like, reading this, because I think that this is, you know, we think about high concept novels and, you know, sort of like what's happening in the world, what's happening among these, you know, friends, these people when a plague starts eradicating everybody. And I think you get a different story these days because of, you know, just like, I don't know. I actually don't know exactly why that would be the case, but it struck me reading this that, like, despite the high concept sort of plague, it's not really plot driven. So once you move out of the first half into the second half, like, you know, plot would be the thing that propels forward. You know, it would be like, you know, whether this or that person was saved, and, you know, like, you know, stuff like that. And this novel doesn't really invest in that. That said, I did enjoy the second half more, I guess, because I did find most of the drama in the first half just not that interesting or compelling. So
yeah, it felt very inhuman to me, I guess, the drama in the first half, like the interpersonal drama, the character drama, the marriage plots, I did, Patrick, to your point, like the way that Raymond's character shifts, the idea of somebody like Raymond who, you know, at one point wants to be this neo-Napoleonic figure and at another point is completely changed by love. I mean, the ideas that suggests about how narrowly somebody might go in radically different directions with their lives, about how, like, history is maybe so changed by the very small actions of an individual person. That's very interesting stuff. But, I mean, that a lot of that interest is kind of just buried among just a lot of interpersonal conflict and drama that just sort of felt like very, and I'm not an expert on this stuff, so maybe somebody who is could tell me how I'm wrong about this, but it just felt like very stock 19th century English fiction, you know, like things that I'm very used to, like a kind of bloated, genericized version of something that you would have gotten in a lot of novels from this period. And, you know, there's some percentage that's interesting, but there's a lot of it that's just completely stock. And once the plague comes, it feels like something unprecedented in fiction is happening, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's not necessarily good from the standpoint of contemporary writing, but it's intriguing, and it does achieve a kind of dark majesty, right? Just these endless pages after pages after pages of, you know, people dying and misery, and all told in 19th century English prose. Like, the kind of total darkness of it happening in the framework of writing from a period where it was unusual for things to be that just completely, utterly, apocalyptically bleak. It does have a moving, sweeping quality to it, even if, you know, ultimately there's not much of what we would normally consider to be interest or drama. And I wonder if that, I was thinking a little bit about, like, the characters all near the end, the kind of remaining band of survivors, they all decide that they have to go to Switzerland because, you know, they just kind of have this idea that maybe, like, the climate in Switzerland will be helpful against the plague, and maybe will, because there's this whole kind of cycle where things are terrible in the summer and then you get a break in the winter, and then a bunch of people die in the summer and you get a break in the winter. And they seem to kind of have the idea that if they go to the right kind of climate, maybe they will be safer from the plague. But then they get to Switzerland and the narrator, Lionel, kind of thinks, well, we knew everybody here was dead too, so I'm not really sure why we thought it would help to go to Switzerland. It just kind of feels like they have to do something, right? Mm-hmm. Like they need to have some plan. They need to be taking some action. And on some level, they understand that it's pointless and futile, but they don't really understand, or even though like an outside, like as a reader, you're thinking, well, like, what's the point of being anywhere? Everybody's dead everywhere, right? But they can't quite admit that until they're in Switzerland. And you could almost read that as like, that seems very philosophical to me, right? These people kind of insisting to themselves that they have to do something in the face of, in fact, the ultimate futility of all action. And yeah, I like that. That's interesting. And I don't know how much that's deliberate or how much that's just, you know, my own way of reading it. But I, by the same token, there's just so much of it, right? There's so much mm-hmm. text here. There's so much prose here. And so much of it is ultimately redundant. I do think that you could cut this down to something that had about 40% of the length and still have everything that's interesting and effective about it. And that's probably part of why it has not had the resurrection that you would think it might in a time when it now feels like it was innovating a lot of things that have become very common in other pop culture.
Yeah. I mean, I could definitely see some some business person in Hollywood being like, hey, here is a public domain novel that we could take and make a series, and all we would have to do is like update the time, because you could drop like the 1800 prose and, you know, just have this be, you know, a generation from now, like 25 years from now.
Right. You could still set it in 2070. We would just, would have a more credible idea of what 2070 would be.
Right.
But you could do like a steampunk or a Victorian steampunk 2070 where like people are dressed, not Victorian's the wrong, but like people are dressed as though they're, you know, from the early 19th century, but it's, you know, the 2070s. Maybe you keep them. Maybe I had just a quick question about this, because like, was the dialogue so florid in Frankenstein? I didn't remember it being like this. It felt really wrought, like very, very wrought in The Last Man. Or am I just misremembering?
I don't remember the dialogue in Frankenstein particularly vividly, but I do think that, you know, Frankenstein felt like something that kind of came in this sudden burst of inspiration. And there are many ways that Frankenstein is, I think, you know, when we did Frankenstein, we talked about this on the Frankenstein podcast, right? Like, a lot of what's interesting about Frankenstein as a text is how little you're actually told, how little you're given of any kind of process or concrete imagery about what any of this looks like. And that actually is very intriguing, right? That emptiness that emptiness is very imaginatively provocative. And if you can let go of all the iconography that film has given us for Frankenstein, it's actually a very imaginatively rich text. And it's like there's some aspect of that, I think, here, but not really in an effective way, because it's been replaced with just such a giant amount of florid dialogue and narration, right? Which does seem like something that, it's like she kind of is coming closer to the contemporary, like Frankenstein is this kind of left field thing from a young person just coming out of writing out of sheer inspiration. And this feels more like somebody writing to a defined idea of what important prose is.
Yeah. And there's the emptiness kind of comes out sometimes as like exposition, especially over points that I was particularly interested in. I was frustrated when Lionel is making a case for why he should be deputy instead of Adrian. So he's basically like shitting on Adrian and in an appeal to be kind of put in charge of...
Well, he wants to save Adrian from the responsibility, right?
Yeah, but it's like a really... I mean, but you start with dialogue at that point, but then you move into And then I told them that Adrian, you know, I don't remember, you know, is a shitbird, and, you know, and I actually, I'm, you know, the best person to do it. And it was like, and then Adrian is mad, to be, for Lionel, who is supposed to be nominating Adrian. And a lot of that is handled in a way that it feels like it's just sort of skating over, like, what I want to hear about, the kind of like the moments of like tension that I want. So it's simultaneously florid and then not actually like,
it's florid, but also expository. Not, it doesn't.
Yes.
And like, I actually, like, I love Jane Austen, but I think Jane Austen does that too, to a less florid and less expository, but a little expository. And I do think to some extent it's like a technique of the times. You know, Jane Austen died in 1815, and most of her books, you know, would have been set like 25, well, not 25 years earlier, because this is set in 2070, but, you know, set 25 years earlier than, or 15 years earlier than this was written. But I feel like the expositoriness in Austen is like ballooned in this novel, and which I do think is problematic. You know, instead of getting any scenes in which we see Raymond being a warrior or a statesman, we get florid exposition about it, which is definitely frustrating. So yeah, pacing.
And the same thing goes for when the plague does occur,
right.
there are interesting scenes and interesting vignettes and interesting kind of bits of important human drama that are just kind of tossed away in a paragraph. You know, like there's a bit that I found very interesting and affecting about how there would be, during the time of the plague, during the time of everybody dying off, there would be certain lovers who were suddenly able to be together because obstacles to their marriage, financial obstacles, family obstacles, were erased by death, right? And so they would have these kind of, they would have the opportunity to pursue these loves that they wouldn't think that they'd be able to. And that's such an interesting concept. And, you know, you could get 100 pages out of that and it would be very affecting, but instead you get a paragraph out of it and then a lot of other stuff that's just not as effective. It feels, it just feels very unedited, right? It feels like something written by someone who has enough commercial clout to not be edited, and it's a disservice that it's not.
Byron and Shelley were both dead, so the two people she would have probably had read this weren't there to do it.
Right, and I don't know enough about what publishing would have been like in 1826 to know if she would have had an editor in the conventional sense that we would think of it now.
Right.
Or if, you know, if an author who didn't have the kind of clout that she would have had at that point from the success of Frankenstein maybe would have had somebody that would behave like a contemporary editor, pushing her to trim and to play up the bits that worked. And and I think, like, going back to what we were saying at the beginning about this being partly a therapeutic exercise, partly something that she admits in the prologue was done as a way of distracting her from her own sorrows with this kind of imaginative version of the sadness of her own life. You can understand why it maybe would be, not to use too unkind a word, but sloppily written, right? Or kind of gushed out in this sort of mass of text that then was not brought into a more conventional form. And none of this is really, I don't know, like, I don't want this to all sound like a condemnation, because I do think that fundamentally, I mean, I'm glad that I'm familiar with this now. I'm glad that I've read it. I'm glad that I know it's this interesting artifact that exists. And I have a lot of admiration, actually, for the emotional honesty of it and the rawness of it and the creativity of it, right? The way that she seems to be taking these circumstances of personal despair and turning them into this work that, you know, sets the template for something that would become a very common fictional schema, sets that template 100 and some years ahead of when it actually became a thing that worked regularly in fiction. If there are versions of this idea before this, I don't know what they are, right? I mean, other than like the Book of Revelation or something, but I'm not aware of any fictional predecessor to either of the, either the idea of the kind of apocalyptic plague or the idea of people wandering through a deserted world. You almost couldn't have had that before this point because people just didn't like think about the world on that scale before the Industrial Revolution. So it's interesting. This is another thing that I think you could either read as a weak point or as just a very interesting quirk of the time that it was written, right? But like, it's so odd that all these things are happening in the 2090s, and it's just technologically clearly the world of the early 1800s.
Right, yeah.
In 2090, everybody's still using horses and carriages, and there's no, you know, and writing letters that are sent by horse. And
using balloons with wings to fly around.
Right. It must have been, and, you know, there are people who maybe could refine this idea, but this must have been like one of the very last times in, at least in Western society, that someone thinking about the future would imagine that it would basically be like the present, right? Like, we've internalized the idea now that 100 years from now we'll just be unimaginably changed by technology. And that's been even, I don't know, like Jules Verne, right? Like, after maybe the 18, basically after the Industrial Revolution, that's like something that would always have been taken for granted by anybody who tried to envision the future. And this is like the very last point in history that someone could honestly, in good faith, attempt to envision the far future and take it for granted that the technological structure of our lives would be the same. And that's another thing that makes it both kind of clunky to read, but also very intriguing I keep using this word, but very intriguing as an artifact.
Maybe that's why, you know, I was saying like there's like a, it's a high concept novel, you know, speculative fiction, you know, novel written about the future. And yet it doesn't have those, what is it called? CSIER, the drama that it makes people talking about, you know, the entertainment of it is experts talking about their expertise. What is, there's a term for that. I can't think of what it is.
Procedural? Is that what you're talking about?
No, it's close. But basically, you know, when you read, you know, military fiction nowadays, you know, you get like a paragraph about the, you know, how the gun works, and you get, you know, or science fiction set in the future, you know, usually like in high concept, you know, speculative fiction, you get this, there's this aspect to it that's really building up and invested in fleshing out the operational aspects of the space and how things work. And maybe what you're talking about, Hans, is why I felt like that was sort of absent in this novel, because like this is at the end of a period where, you know, I've heard it said basically like Napoleon's military, Napoleon's army would have a hard time with Alexander the Great's army. Like, and that's so crazy, like, to think about, because they're separated by, you know, 1,000 years. And yet, this is at the tail end of that. This is where you don't invest that much time in you know the science fiction-y aspects of the future because it looks, like you said, like the present.
Bearing that in mind, why do you think she said it so far in the future?
I don't know.
I struggle with that question a lot too, because so the start of the book, we've moved from a monarchical system to a republican system, which would have just been kind of coming into its own. In 1818 or 1826, the English monarchy would have been, you know, substantially powerful, and whereas today it's not powerful at all. But it's still like republicanism, the idea of like parliaments and wider representation for, you know, the gentry and you know, wealthy merchants and things like this, that had been like coming into the British system for at least, you know, a couple centuries before this, right? Before 1826. And then I don't know what year the English system became like a full parliament, but like in 1826 we would have had a monarchical system with a parliamentary system together. At least I'm pretty sure that's historically accurate. So it definitely seems interesting to me that she need to imagine another 250 years to elapse before a full parliamentary system would take over. So that seems a little strange to me.
Was that like ass covering in some way? Like it would have been politically or socially dangerous to publish a novel where the monarchy went away in 10 years?
Right.
So she put it so far out in the future that it kind of gave her plausible deniability about it being an attack on the contemporary monarchy?
I mean, that's...
There's probably scholarship on this, I would imagine, but maybe there's not. I don't know how much formal scholarly attention this novel's ever gotten. I was not able to find much, but I could have scoured harder than I did.
That makes sense.
It just seems like it would be wiser to, to the extent that you're going to speculate about something like that, wiser to distance it from being a critique of whoever's in power at the moment. And I don't know. It is interesting, though, there's kind of a dreamlike quality to the relationship of those parts, right? Like, why does your novel about, like, in a way, anything could happen in the first 40% of this novel.
Right.
As long as at some point, oh, there's the plague.
I have an idea about this, but go on.
I don't have an idea, really. I was just going to say that it has kind of like a, again, you know, the way that this feels so unedited, like the relationship between those parts is to me is part of what made it feel unedited, right? Like it just has kind of like a one thing after another kind of quality to it. And so if you have a sense of how those actually are important relative to each other, I'd be really curious.
Well, sure. So it has to do with your question about the political statement of the novel. So initially I was like, why do we have this big, long intro about Raymond becoming the leader of fully Republican England before, you know, why spend so much time on this when, you know, everything's going to break down from the plague later on? You know, why not speed through that? And like, I still think it would probably be a better novel if we, like you said, we limited this to about 40% of what it currently is. But I think that part of the, and I'm not sure what the political statement is, but I think her main thematic purpose in this novel is to contrast the romanticism of Raymond with the more logical or the more pragmatic leadership of Adrian. So at one point, Raymond and Adrian both are the Lord Protectorates of England, right? And Raymond is the Lord Protectorate before the plague, and then after the plague, Adrian takes over. And I think that the point of the novel is to set up this big contrast between these two types of leadership. And maybe it's a statement against the novel that I'm not sure what it's saying about those two types of leadership. I'm not sure, but I think that's where, like, the main purpose of the novel is. You would think that it's trying to side with Adrian, I guess.
Is Adrian pragmatic?
I don't know if he's pragmatic, but he's more laconic.
He's definitely more humanist.
Yeah, he's more humanist. And that's like. I'm not exactly sure which side we're meant to, like, take, or if we're meant to take a side, but it does seem to be about these two distinct characters in roles of leadership. I'm an idiot.
Well, I guess ultimately neither of them matter very much because everyone dies.
Right, exactly. The plague really messes this novel up as far as I'm concerned. Like, it's what's interesting. It's the thing that's most plot interesting about this novel. But to my mind, the beginning is still more interesting thematically. And it's so hard to explain because it seems so, it's just so unclear. But the idea of a war between Greece and Turkey is clearly reminiscent of the Trojan War and harkens back to this heroic era and this romantic story. But what's the purpose of that? I'm not sure.
Is the plague somehow a consequence of that war? Because the plague starts within the city of Constantinople, right? And everybody says, oh, I don't know if you should go in there. Like, they're pretty sick in there. But everybody just kind of says, ah, fuck it. Nope, we're invading Constantinople. Is it somehow a punishment for militarism, for war?
That would align with the idea that we're meant to, like, approve of Adrian's version of leadership over Raymond's, because Raymond's the more warrior type leader. So if the plague comes out of war, if war is a plague, that at least makes sense. I don't know how well it's supported by the text.
There's this kind of mysterious idea that somehow Evadne has caused it.
Right.
Like, that's another strange character. The whole little kind of thing where she sends in architectural drawings to Raymond and he sees them and goes, man, these are incompetent but amazing.
Right.
And then
yeah, like it doesn't make any sense. Like,
right. They don't work as architecture, but they're so beautiful that I have to seek out the anonymous person who made them up. And then is she some kind of, like, genius who also somehow breeds this plague? Is she like a secret bioengineer?
Yeah.
or what we would now think of as a bioengineer? Is that like, I don't know. Is this something that she has made either through some kind of arcane science or just through sheer kind of witchcraft?
I don't know. I don't know.
Very, very interesting, very creative, very moving in some ways, very flawed novel.
That's what I would say.
You said you're sympathetic to it, Patrick. Did we get to what you were sympathetic for?
Well, I mean, I mentioned that, like, I was very intrigued by Raymond as a character. That's why I probably liked the first half more, because he's in the first half and then he dies. I found him interesting because of, like I said, the shift in his ambitions after falling in love with Perditor. I really liked the scene where, you know, Perdita has found out about Evadne, and he's like, you know, if you're gonna be a suspicious person about it, let's just end this right now, so we don't have to deal with all the pain and recrimination. And I liked that scene. I don't know. I just thought Raymond was a super, super cool character, so I was sympathetic to that. I was very sympathetic to, like, what seemed to me an allusion to the Trojan War in the war between Greek and Troy. And you know, as expository as the writing is, it's often very good. You know, it is often very, you know, the expressions are interesting, the descriptions of, you know, you could pick out a description and it's probably good. So there is a lot to like, there's a lot to be sympathetic towards in this novel, even though, like I said, the pacing is off and there are plot aspects that don't make sense or that don't work very well.
It is very, like, I wish now that I could, like, meet certain contemporary artists and ask them if they're aware of this novel, right? Because I'm very curious about how, whether it's, like, influential or coincidental in terms of its relationship to contemporary things, right? Like, the fact that there was a sitcom called The Last Man on Earth about Will Forte,
right,
in an empty world wiped out by plague, like, did they read this book? Did they know of it? Were they consciously trying to create a sitcom out of this novel? Or was it just entirely, did they just happen to come up with a concept that resonates because all the pieces were already there in other parts of the culture, you know? Or like,
I mean, I've seen some episodes and it's got nothing to do with this.
Right. Other than the title and the premise.
Right. Yeah.
Which are not insignificant. Like I love that show. I watched that whole show. And yeah, no, it has no detail level relationship, but like title and premise ain't
right,
nothing.
That's,
you know,
true.
There's also, when Lionel finds himself at the end, he jumps into a few, like, supercars that used to belong to.
Have either of you guys seen Station 11?
I did. I've read it, too.
Do you remember, Chris? There's a scene in Station 11 where they're doing Hamlet, right? And I can't remember. Kirsten, I think, is the character's name, is, like, while she's performing Hamlet, she is, if I understood what the editing was meant to imply, she's, like, thinking about her memories of the beginning of the pandemic as, like, actorly processed to get into the right emotional space for the role.
Mm-hmm. I vaguely remember that, yeah.
And right around the time that I saw the episode where that happens, I also read the sequence in this novel where they're watching a performance of Macbeth, and Macduff learns that his whole family has just died. And it just, like, wipes the theater out because everybody in the crowd has had a similar experience. Like hearing the character say, oh my God, my wife and children, oh my God, they're all dead. It's just like so powerful for everyone in the audience because they've lived that, you know? And that's not the same scene, but it's so similar. And those two scenes are so resonant with each other in such interesting ways. Like, again, like it could just be totally coincidental, or it could be that the one is somehow drawing on the other or in tribute to the other or in conversation with the other. I don't know.
I was going to say, for me, I think the parts of the novel that stick out are the middle for that reason, because I think it's just resonant, interesting that like the plague is a problem, but there's the attendant fracture of society and the famine and people sort of I remember Lionel goes into like a cabin to like check on someone who's been infected, and everyone's just sort of avoiding them, and there's this way that like the fear of the plague is captured and the way that it's hitting people that like in when it hasn't like basically ravaged everything. That's my favorite part of this novel. And I hadn't thought about it, Hans, but it might be because there's a lot in sort of the stories that are told today, you know, The Stand, Station 11, there's a bunch, but basically like it felt very prescient for how we would be telling those stories today. If it didn't directly influence them. That's what I was going to say, Patrick. What were you going to say?
I feel like these things are coincidental. If anybody in the entire world has heard about and cared about and read this novel, it would be people like us, right? And none of us have read it before now. So
by people like us, do you mean people without cultural power?
No. I mean people who are very interested in literature.
Okay, you mean that like if we haven't heard of it, probably very few people.
Right, exactly, is what I'm saying. Like,
I had that thought as well, but it seemed arrogant to say it so explicitly.
Well, I just mean, you know, like, I don't mean to be arrogant. I just mean, like, we all have master's degrees in writing or literature or both. And
I think both in almost all of our cases, yeah. Like the whole, we have a great deal of education whose whole ostensible point is to make us aware that things like that.
Right, exactly. And that's all I'm saying. Like, I'm not saying this makes us better. I'm just saying that, like, if we haven't heard of it and read it, then I doubt the guy who you know, created The Last Man on Earth or, you know, read this.
And I think that you saying that sort of like surfaces for me the part of me that enjoyed this book, because I did enjoy it, was almost entirely that lit studies part of me. Like, Frankenstein is like amazing.
Yeah.
I love Frankenstein. Frankenstein is an incredible novel. I really wish that the other part of me, the other reader part of me, enjoyed The Last Man half as much. But it is very interesting to think about. I am thankful to have read it.
Agreed. I do think this is an interesting novel to think about. And really, despite the fact that this podcast conversation has been more critical, really, I didn't even have a bad time listening to it. you know, like, unlike, say, like, Lookout Cartridge, no offense, I was just thinking of a novel that we have read that I, like, just did not have a good time listening to, you know?
Right, and Lookout Cartridge was hard both to read and to discuss.
And, like, while this is a very flawed novel, the experience of taking it in wasn't a bad experience at all.
No, not at all. Well, Patrick, what not bad experience are you going to give us for 2 weeks?
I don't think it is a bad experience. So my friend Heather, who I've mentioned is one of my two board game friends, she read my Gusano novel and said, you know, I have read another book that Gusano reminds me of. And she said, you should read it. And it's called Earthlings by Sayaka Murata. It's a Japanese novel translated into English.
All right. Well, thank you much, everybody, for listening to this reconstruction from a podcast script that I found in the floor of a cave. If you have thoughts, questions, comments, reach out to us at, what is it, Patrick?
BookSpider1001@gmail.com. Remember, we talked about buying BookSpider@gmail.com for $100 from whoever has that email a while back.
That would have been a wise thing to do.
Yeah. We still probably could.
They'd probably charge us more now.
Yeah, because we're so popular.
Well, no, just because if we came crawling back now, they'd know we really wanted.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Well, thank you much for your time, everybody, and I hope you all have a good rest of your week. We'll see you in 2 weeks for Earthlings by Sayaka Murata.
Thank you, guys.
Peace out, gentlemen.